I'm done.
Hey guys, I'm Larry Scott, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
And as I said, I'm free tonight. Introducing this guy is like falling off a log for me. Hunter walked into my life a little over a year ago. He came up after We Are Not a Glum Lot book study, and he said, I'd like to know if you would sponsor me. And I have a set question that I always ask. I just looked him in the eye, and I said, why? And he didn't stutter. He said, because I've heard your story, I've been through this book study, and I want what you have. And I said, that's a good answer. And we got to work. And after a number of treatment facilities, Hunter did the work. He took the steps. And he put this program to action in his life. And it's been like purchasing a movie at IMAX and watching his life explode. He's gone from a halfway house to a life that is incredibly huge, just huge, all aspects. And he's going to come up and share that with us tonight. I love this cat, man, and you guys are in store for a treat. Meet my friend Hunter.
My name's Hunter Dean. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 4th of 2009. So to correct Larry real quick, it's a year and a half that I came into life. My home group is We Are Not a Glum Lot Big Book Study. Chris and Larry do it Thursday nights at Mount Vernon, and it's at 8 p.m., and we'd love to have you. I'd like to thank Bob for asking me to come out here tonight and speak with you guys. It's an honor and a privilege to do so. And to kind of reiterate on what he said, I can hope to do two things. I can hope to inspire you in some way, shape, or form, or I can hope to really disturb you on the concept of alcoholism. So that's what I'm going to try and do. I'm 22 years old. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and lived there my entire life. I've only been here in Atlanta for a little over 2 years. Oldest of two kids, little brother, and two good parents. I did not grow up in an alcoholic home. I did not suffer any form of abuse or, stuff like that that some of us do have to encounter as kids. It was a pretty functional home. You know, church on Sundays, going to school every day, and life was pretty good. I can recall being a young kid and loving to do things that I knew were wrong. I loved to be mischievous, whether that was, I remember when I was like four, I'd be rollerblading down a hill, and I just loved saying like every cuss word, or four or five, I loved to say like every cuss word. I just thought that was so cool to be able to do that at a young age, you know, cruising down in the wind and just cussing like a storm. It was all about me as a kid, and it is all about me from time to time today, too. I do suffer from a very high level of selfishness and self-centeredness. Thankfully, the steps have shown me a way how to not do that all the time. So, when I was about six or seven, and to go ahead and make this clear, this did not cause my alcoholism. I got to make that very, very, very strong point. A guy who's a couple years older than me kind of, made me do sexual encounter with him and stuff like that. And I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was so young, so I didn't think anything of it. I remember not wanting to do it, but I did it. And I remember immediately just stuffing that down, deep down. I can remember at age 12 or 13 on a school trip in D.C., Washington, D.C., that memory came back, and it just freaked me out. And I remember just being ridden with instant anxiety and instant fear and just knowing, being so convinced being so convinced that there was something wrong with me, that I was not normal because this had happened to me. I had my first drink before that, and I just know that I drank a lot of gin, and I got really sick. and it felt really good. But I look at that today, and I still just wonder, why do people drink gin? That's just a terrible thing. Awful stuff. Got real sick. Probably not going to do this again. And, you know, of course, the next couple of years throughout life are spent, very, you know, experimenting and smoking pot and stuff of that nature. And I remember I really liked the way that alcohol and drugs made me feel. I remember, you know, starting high school and that just terror, man, instant terror, being feeling like I was alone in the world. And I knew that the drugs and the alcohol would make that fear go away. It allowed me to interact with you guys in a way that I felt comfortable doing so. I wasn't scared running around all the time, ridden with anxiety. I was able to talk with girls. I was able to go out and have a good time. I love what Kip Collins says. He talks about his first drink and how he immediately turned his will and his life over to alcohol. And I can completely relate to that statement, because alcohol and drugs did for me what nothing else could. It was the strongest stuff that I had ever put in my body, and the most amazing experience I'd ever had, being, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old. Selfishness again. You know, I can remember just going throughout high school, doing what I'm going to do. Screw you if you're going to get in my way. Mom and Dad, don't got anything to do with you. I'm not going to follow your rules. I'm going to bring drugs into your house and drink in your house and cause chaos, and I'm going to treat y'all like crap, and I'm going to treat my little brother like crap, because it's all about me. And if it's not going my way, I'm going to be a little kid about it and pitch a fit. And that's how it pretty much is for a while. You know, again, I go back to, I'm raised in church, and I'm so scared of the concept of God, because I know that my behavior and outlook on life does not seek the approval of the God of my conception at the time. I'm just thinking, yeah, I'm just like waiting. He's just like waiting. He's ready to bolt me, man. And, you know, I'm scared. I'm just scared. I'm running throughout life scared of God. I'm always feeling uncomfortable in church. And I can remember immediately turning my back on any form of God. I was a senior in high school, and I was diagnosed with a gastrointestinal disease, which is called Crohn's disease. And I remember just wallowing in self-pity because of that. Because I thought, you know, my perception at the time was, if God really loves me, why would he do this to me? So I immediately, you know, I didn't want anything to do with the God of that nature. Earl Hightower talks about it. I love it. He's in Mexico, and his family is just, his plane has just crashed. And his sister, mom, and dad are all dead, and he's sitting there, and he's broken arms, broken legs, and he's just sitting there crippled. And he's got this sweet little sister he's looking at over, and he's noticed that she's dead, and he immediately turns his back on God, because he's got no room for a God that can take a loving, you know, innocent sister that he has, good child, and leave him, dope fiend, to live. And I can totally relate to that. I'm drinking like a fish throughout my high school, my senior year of high school. It's all about drinking. And the doctor's telling me, you got to stop drinking. It's not good for Crohn's disease. No, it's all good. I'll keep drinking. And St. Paddy's Day, 2007. Everybody can relate to it. Wild St. Paddy's Day, I don't even have to ask you. And I end up the next morning, I can't stand up straight. I've got to go to the hospital. And I've got an obstruction and an abscess. And they have to perform surgery within the next couple of days. I can remember being in the ER, being injected with some narcotics, and loving the way that it felt. Been looking to feel that good for a long time, liking what everything else was doing, but really liking the way that felt. And, you know, the bright idea after the hospital experience seemed to be, you know, and again, the doctor's like, you got to stop drinking. But the smart idea was, okay, well, I'll just stop drinking so much, and I'll just start doing these heavy narcotics, and that way everything will work out, you know? And that was the beginning of the end, was senior year of high school, going into college the next year. Chasing that feeling. And I'm lying to people, and I'm not able to maintain a relationship with the girl I'm seeing at the time. I'm not able to be a good brother. I'm not able to be a son, a friend. I can't keep a job. I'm skipping class. I mean, I just can't do anything right because my primary purpose is to get out of my head immediately when I wake up in the morning and to find that alcohol or find that whatever and get it into my body as soon as possible. And that's how it is for me. I identify as an alcoholic, but this is part of my story. And what I was getting involved in, something you have to start taking or else you start getting sick. And so it's not only about just getting loaded anymore, it's about not getting sick and just feeling normal. It's not about, you know, enjoying the way I'm feeling, but not feeling the way I don't want to feel. That's what it's about. And I'm a slave 24/7, and I'm stealing from my mom, my own mom, my biggest fan in the world. I'm stealing, man. I'm a mess. I'm ripping people off. I am completely insane. The girl I'm seeing dumps me. Shocker there. And I'm just freaked out by that. So the right and perfect solution at the time is to go ahead and drive over to her house, try and get it worked out. Plus she's got some of my things, so I got to go get my stuff. And I'm on the street to her house. I'm about five houses away. And the idea comes, drive into a tree, man. Maybe she'll feel sorry for you. Maybe she'll take you back, you know. Maybe a near-death experience will realize that you're the right one for her. So that's what I did. I go head onto a tree. I didn't get it fast. I was going about 35 miles an hour. I ended up breaking my wrist doing so. And I remember I called her and told her, and I remember her mom calls me immediately. She's like, Hunter, get out of that median right now and pull into my driveway if you can. You're going to get arrested. And, you know, it's one of those things that God does for me that I can't do for myself. And my car starts up. I put it in reverse. I start to drive off. And as soon as I start to drive off, a cop starts coming over the hill. And I'm able to pull into this driveway and be okay. Throughout my alcoholism, active alcoholism and addiction, I can recall about three moments of clarity off the top of my head where I was able to see where my life was really at. The first one came that night after I went to the hospital and I got my hand wrapped up and all that. It hit me that it's not about partying anymore. This is not just about having fun and getting loaded and laughing and hanging out with your friends. I just drove my SUV into an oak tree in an attempt to gain some sympathy. But my boy Christian right here, Salvation Army, his mother calls, Christian, you just party too much. Mom, the party's long gone. And I can completely relate to that too. So the idea comes, all right, I'll check into rehab. I need to get detoxed. I need to get these chemicals out of my system, and I'll get detoxed, and I'll be good. I'll be ready again. So I checked into a detox center in Memphis, and you know, get to start detoxing, start feeling a little bit better, start feeling a little bit clearer in my head. And they're telling me, you know, after this, you need to go to AA or NA meetings, and you need to find a sponsor, and you need to work the steps. And, you know, I look up at the steps as I'm in the inpatient. I'm not really identifying with anything. That whole word powerless over alcohol or powerless over drugs is something that really hasn't applied to me just yet. I'm not ready to go there. Clearly, my life's unmanageable. That's a no-brainer. But the whole deal with being powerless over drugs and alcohol, no way. I've just hit a bad bump in the road. I got to get back on my feet, and everything will be good. I think the third day out of treatment, treatment's such a place. I don't want to say a good place, but it's a place to meet people who have had experiences that you haven't had yet. And unfortunately, I met someone like that, and I identify as an alcoholic, but this is part of my story. IV drugs is the next choice, and that seems to be the good idea. God, back another incident with God, I'm out of treatment for 3 days, and I'm set off to go to school at UT Chattanooga, and I'm on my way home, and I'm about a mile down the road, and the next thing I know, I'm in someone's yard, and I'm spinning out. And there's trees everywhere, huge oak trees. This is in a neighborhood where there's children running around. And I immediately grab the wheel, hit the brakes, and I spin out into the middle of a three-way intersection without hitting anything but a stop sign. Cars are everywhere. thank God no one is dead today because of that. Thank God I didn't kill myself today and leave my parents with all that. That's another instance of God working in my life before I could see it. The next couple of months is just trying to figure out that right, perfect solution to drinking and using successfully. And it's just, you know, I'll make it 5 days, I'll make it 7 days, doing it this way, but I always end up going back to what I was to ground zero, man. I always end up going back. And the insanity of alcohol is just so baffling. I mean, I will sit there and tell you before I take a drink or whatever that I'm not going to do this tomorrow. And I mean it with every fiber of my being. I'm not going to do this tomorrow. Or I'll tell you, this is the only one I'm taking today. And I'll wake up the next morning. The only choice I have is to take that pill or whatever, drug or alcohol. That's the only choice that I have. I don't like to use bad language, but you've heard of the fuck it. And I got to tell this because I think this is great. It describes the insanity of alcohol in such a good way. The counselor I'm working with at the time, he's like, okay, let's say you got a fifth of Jack Daniels for each day, Monday through Friday. So, you know, Monday rolls around and you take that fifth, you take it all, and immediately you're starting to think, well, I'm not ready to stop drinking for the day. Okay, this is what I'll do. I'll take Tuesday off, and then Wednesday I'll be back on track, right? So, and there comes that point where, screw it. And I take it. I plan it out, but I'm not able to see how it really is. And I ended up failing every single time. I'm in Chattanooga, actually. Somehow I've convinced my parents that I am stable physically and mentally to go back to school in January of 2009. And so I went back and kind of detoxed myself off of the alcohol and the drugs. And it was a week before I was back doing it again. I'm stealing from people. I'm driving to Knoxville back and forth every single day to get what I have to get in order to be okay. And this is that second moment of clarity that I'm about to tell you about. And I got to go to the book with this because it just speaks so loudly for me. On page 152, it says, he will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. And that's where I'm at. I don't want to use and drink more than anything in the world. It's the last thing I want to do. Yet I am bursting in tears because it's the only thing I know how to do and I can't not do it. And I don't know why. And it's baffling. I tell the girl that I spoke about earlier that I'm going to kill myself if she doesn't come and pick me up. That I'm going to jump to go to the bridge that crosses the Tennessee River in downtown Chattanooga. That I'm going to jump if you don't come and pick me up. And the sickness about that is, the sickest part is I was never going to jump. It was a pure tactic of manipulation to get her to come pick me up because I knew she would. And that's what I act like when I'm on alcohol and drugs. That's the kind of stuff I do. After about the fifth time of doing that, she's finally had enough, and she calls the cops. So the cops, I'm expecting her to show up on the bridge. I'm just walking along, and I see a cop car pull up. He's like, are you Hunter Dean? I'm like, yeah, what? He's like, yeah, we got a 1013 call for you. So they take me to a suicide prevention, or like a crisis center or something like that. And again, it hits me that this ain't about a party anymore, man. I just told someone I'm going to kill myself if they don't come pick me up. So I withdraw from school. I get back to Memphis, kind of just trying to pull off a last hoorah of some sort. Don't go home for a few days. Trade the laptop to the dope man, that kind of stuff. I go up to treatment again in Nashville, and I know my way isn't working. I'm not convinced that this way is going to work, but I know that I'm continuing to fail. I remember when I got to treatment each night, I would read like, you know, 10, 12 pages or a chapter out of the book. And I just started from the very, very beginning. And I started to identify with Bill's writing and his story about his experience and also about, you know, the solution and also about more about alcoholism. I can completely identify with chapter 3 in such a strong way. It's unbelievable. My mind started to open up to this concept of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, working in my life. I have family that's here in Vinings, and they've been in AA for a while. My counselor told me, you got to go to a halfway house. You can't go back home. You're not going to make it. So the idea just comes, well, maybe I should just go down to Atlanta and start fresh somewhere. I've got family down there that's in AA, and, you know, they'd be away from all the people I've been hanging out with. And that works out, and I get down here in March of 2009, and I immediately get a sponsor, and we start, you know, doing a little bit of work. I'm not being completely honest, and I'm not willing to do what, you know, go to any lengths to stay sober. I'm just kind of floating along with the picture to see what happens. And in about 80 days, I ended up relapsing again because I hadn't been doing the work. I remember we had taken a third step, and I hadn't really finished that fourth step. You know, and the book is very specific that after we take the third step, next we launch out on a course of vigorous action. It doesn't say that we sit back and take a break and wait for someone to say, all right, now it's time to do your fourth step. We get after it and we go. And I didn't do that. I ended up using again and drinking again. That relapse was terrible because I had started to experience people who really cared about me and seeing the program work in other people's lives. So it kind of like screwed up, you know, my drinking when I went back out. I felt really guilty about it. And I immediately came back in. And I immediately did 1 through 7 in like one day and got after it. We did that fifth step. And I experienced the promises of the fifth step and had a really cool time doing so. About 4 months sober, I meet a woman in Ridgeview who is inpatient. And she has the same sobriety date as me. And she loves Widespread Panic. And I love Widespread Panic. I've been spending, you know, the past couple of years trying to chase them around at this point in my life. And it's just instant, this is the one. You know? And she loves narcotics, too. So I'm just like, this is it. I don't really have to tell you how that is. You know how it ended. And again, I've completely put a break on making amends and continuing out with the rest of the step work. And I relapsed again. And I've been kicked out of a halfway house now. I've been living with my cousins. I've been kicked out of there for drinking in their house. I'm living with a coworker, you know, barely scraping by. And I'm out of money one morning, and I don't have anywhere to go. And at this point, everyone's like, Hunter, don't call unless there's something that we can do to help you in a positive way. We're sick of it, man. We are sick, and we're sick and tired of hearing about you killing yourself. We've had enough. Don't call. So I'm kind of like backed into a corner at this point. Something tells me to call someone in AA. I'm sure it was God. And I call a buddy in AA, and I tell him what's up, and I tell him I'm hopeless as can be. And he picks me up, takes me to a men's meeting over there at, I think it's at St. Luke's. It's a Saturday morning, 9:30. I think it's at St. Luke's. It's a good group. And he helps me. He puts some gas in my tank. I was initially going to check into Ridgeview and do their young adult deal. But in the assessment room, he's like, you got to go on the waiting list. We can't take you for another week or so. And I'm immediately taking that as a sign. I'm like, you know, I'm screwed. I'm not meant to get sober, blah, 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 blah. So I start kind of freaking out again. And he starts telling me, Hunter, I'll put some gas in your tank, but you're going to have to drive yourself to peace for a brother. Because, you know, if you're really going to do this, it's got to be, you got to be doing it for yourself. Up to this point in my life, I'm trying to get sober to repair relationships or get things back, to get my car back, yada, yada, yada. I'm trying to get sober for all the things, all the wrong reasons. I'm not trying to get sober for myself. And obviously I continue to drink and use. And I remember being so scared of having to drive myself to Peace River, man, being so, so scared, terrified. And I'm sitting in the driveway of the house I'm living in, and I cannot start the key, man. I cannot get myself to do it. And so I called another guy, and God intervened in a very miraculous way. This guy gave me so much love and encouragement and motivation. And finally, I was like, all right, screw it. I'm going. I'm going to get sober. And so I got into Peachford. And at this point, and again, I'm going to reiterate a little bit, I continue to relapse because I'm half measuring the program. I'm not getting sober for myself. So therefore, I'm not getting long-term quality sobriety. I got to go back to the book for this because this part of the book is just, it's one of my favorite parts. It's in Bill's story. And Bill's just got done getting his butt kicked again. Whew, I love this. He says, for a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. And I've gotten checked in, and something tells me I need to pray, I know this is a God deal, and I don't have God, and I don't have a clue who God is or what he's got in store for me. But something tells me I just need to pray. I need to start this off on the right foot, man. And so I go back into my room, and I get down on my knees. The lights are all turned out. I'm in there all by myself. And I can't tell you what I said verbatim, but it was something to the effect of, God, I can't do this without you. I know I need you now. Please help me. And as I'm going about that prayer, my whole body starts to tingle, and tears just start to stroll down my face, man, and tears of pain and tears of joy. And immediately, the obsession to drinking use is gone. I'm still a real sick person, but I don't want to drink and use anymore. I get out of detox. I get into a halfway house over in Shambly Dunwoody area, and the place that I'm living at takes all of the patients, clients, whatever you want to call them, to We Are Not a Glum Lot on Thursday night. And I've heard both of these guys speak the previous summer when I was living in Vinings. And remember that both of them, I knew after hearing both of them speak that if I really, really want to do this, it might be a good idea to go talk to one of these two guys. I approached Larry after the meeting. I asked him to be my sponsor, and he was like, yeah. He asked, why? I said, because I want what you have. And I didn't want to repair a relationship anymore. I didn't want to get something back, a job back or anything like that. I was willing to do absolutely anything to stay sober, and I knew that Larry would lead me on the right path. Step one at that point was clearly obvious. We didn't need to talk too much about how I was powerless over alcohol and drugs and how unmanageable my life was. It was very evident. And, again, I go back, I'm raised in church and I'm so scared of God. And the concept of God just freaks me out, man. And Larry and I are driving around Alpharetta, and it's a real cold January winter day. And we start to talk about step two. And we pull up to a stoplight, and at the stoplight, there's a bed of pansies that are alive and well in this little flower bed. And he goes, all right, Hunter, I would invite you to get out right now, take all your clothes off, go spend the night in the flower bed. I'll come pick you up tomorrow morning at about 3 o'clock. And I look at him, I'm like, wait, shut up, man, it's crazy. I'll die. It's 15 degrees outside. Why would you have me do this? And he immediately responds with, but would those flowers die? I said, well, no, they wouldn't. And he goes, so that's the power greater than yourself. And when he said that, it was just, the light switch turned on. Because Larry helped me see the simplicity behind the second step. That there's no definition of who God is and what he is to me. I don't have to define God and figure out who God is and what he's going to do. I just have to be willing to believe. I don't even have to believe in God. I have to be willing to believe that there's something outside of me that can take care of all the problems that I've been trying to take care of on my own for some time and continue to fail doing so. And when I just remember when, you know, when we got I got home that day and I was alone, I just felt so much relief behind that, knowing that that was the truth behind the second step, that I didn't have to know who God is or what He was going to do, that I could just kind of sit back and let it happen. And that's what I do with people today. You know, I was with a sponsee a couple of weeks ago, and you know, I said, buddy, I would invite you to go grab this oak tree up by your arms and hands and just go ahead and root it out of the ground. And he kind of looks at me like I'm an idiot, you know. And he goes, I can't do that. Well, no duh. And I said, well, what about, you know, F5 tornado comes in and sweeps that thing right off his ass. Is the tornado more powerful than you? Yes. So there's a power greater than yourself out there. And that's the deal. I'm so glad that Larry used that with me today, because I kind of shape it up every single time in a different way when I work with someone today, because it's just such a simple way. It's almost stupid. It's so simple. I remember Larry telling me when I first got sober, you got to be stupid, man. Start being stupid. Stop figuring everything out. And we get down on our knees and we get prepared to take the third step. And in my past, the third step really, really freaks me out in a bad way, because I'm thinking, as soon as I take the third step, that means I have to know what God's will is for me, what His plan is for me, what I'm supposed to do, when I'm supposed to do it. I'm supposed to have my whole life in this book until the time I die, and I'm supposed to know that. I'm sitting there driving myself crazy because I don't know if God wants me to eat a PB&J or a turkey and cheese. You know, like that's how far down I'll take it with my mind. And Larry describes that the third step is nothing more than a decision to go about the rest of a step one. And again, it's like instant release. It's like, man, you mean I don't have to have everything figured out? It's like, no, man. You don't know God. Clearly, you don't know God, and He's right. I've got no relationship with God at this point, so how can I expect to know what God wants me to do if I don't even have a relationship with Him? So we get down on our knees, and we take the step, and He immediately gives me the fourth step. And I get it done in like, you know, 24 hours. I'm just ready to get it done. I'm ready to get sober. And we do our fifth step, you know, a week or two later, and the promises come true again. I get to see where my part is today, or back to that day, I got to see where my part in resentments and fears were, and that I wasn't a victim, and that I wasn't just getting dealt a bad card, and I had no excuse anymore to feel sorry for myself. I remember when we get done with the fifth step, you know, he gives me the instruction out of the book for 6 and 7. And he says, Hunter, just start being nice to people, man. Not such a novel concept for me, is to be nice to someone without expecting them to do anything in return. And just start being nice to people. Help the old woman put her groceries in her trunk. Take the grocery cart back for her. When you're in traffic, God, I hate traffic, man. I get so agitated in this Atlanta traffic, and I want to start cussing people and flipping people off. And unfortunately, sometimes I do react that way. But I can be nice to people today, too. I can let people in. Instead of me worrying about where I need to be, I can let someone get in front of me. And it's those little things. You'd be surprised at how much that boosts your self-esteem, man, when you start thinking about someone else and you're not expecting them to do something for you because you were nice. I go home. I do 6 and 7 as it's outlined in the book. I stay quiet for an hour. An hour. I stayed quiet for 30 minutes the time before, and I drank again. I don't know if that's why I drank. But... I did what it said in that book. I didn't want to take any other chances. It's really hot in here. I'm going to take the jacket off.
Go ahead, buddy.
So Larry and I hook up, a week later, and we write out my list. And I go make my amends. I start making my amends with people. And, you know, it's so vital for me to not go into amends and say, you know, I'm so sorry I did this. But guess what? You know, I'm sober through AA today, and I'm hooking up with God. I know what I did was wrong, but I wanted you to know this is how I'm living today. That's bull crap. That's all ego if I go do that. A proper amend for me is to go approach someone when it's convenient on their time and admit that what I did was wrong, and I can see what I did to you was wrong. is there anything that I can do to make this right? I'm more than willing to do it. Please let me know. And that's that. And I got some responses that I didn't like. I got some responses that reminded me of the pain that I caused in people's life. And I didn't want to hear that. But the beauty is that I was able to see it. I was able to see the truth that, yes, I did hurt people. And then I got some responses that were just, Hunter, we just want you to stay sober. We love you. And, you know, I got some responses. This is great. I'm with my little brother. I've been treating this kid like dirt my entire life. He's living up in Chattanooga at the time, too, in school. And I make a day trip up there to make a few amends. And I take Michael up to Signal Mountain, which is a mountain in Chattanooga that overlooks this gorge into the Tennessee River. You can see Lookout Mountain off in the distance. It's one of the most beautiful things on earth. And I'm sitting there on this rock face, you know, looking out into this valley. And it's a beautiful, bright, sunny day. And I make my amend to my brother. And his immediate response is, you know, I'm thinking, I'm so proud of myself because I just made this great amend, you know. And his immediate response is, well, yeah, Hunter, that's all well and good, but your actions are really going to show me whether you're for real. I'm just like, what? Come on, man. He's 18 years old, and he knows what's up. And he was right. He was so right, man. I can do this. I can come sit in a meeting with you fine people for a few months and start spitting out pearls pretty easily. That's not tough to do, man. It's what am I doing with my actions? Again, I go back to what I love what Kip Collins says. The hardest thing is not learning what's in this blue book. It's about unlearning all the stuff that I thought I already knew. And that is to this very day, that is the toughest thing for me to see where what I'm thinking is wrong and to be open to learning a new way to think and act that way. The ninth step promises come true. I start doing 10 and 11, and I start looking for sponsees. And at about 6 months, I get my first sponsee. Real quick, I'll go back and touch up on my experience with 10 and 12. You know, I hear some people say sometimes that 10 is a written step and that you do it at the end of the day. And that's all well and good if that's the way you do it. A 10th step for me is as I go. So, okay, Whitney, I lie to Whitney and I don't do anything about it. That's not practicing a 10th step. A practicing a 10th step was to admit to Whitney what I did was wrong. To ask God to remove that, to discuss that with her, and to make an amend if there's anything I can do to make it right. And I don't do that all the time. Sometimes I just brush things off. I don't think I need to do it. I don't need to talk about it with somebody. And it doesn't take really hours or a day before I start feeling real selfish and self-centered and angry. And I start picking out what's wrong with you and what you're not doing right. And what you just shared was completely full of crap, man. That's where I'll start getting if I don't take care of that stuff on the front end. 11 has been something I've really had to seek discipline in. It's so easy for me. And I do 11 as it's described out of the book, the prayers out of the book, 84 through 86 or something like that. But it's so easy for me to get real complacent and just to look at that as taking a checkpoint, you know, just checking it off. It's okay, I did that prayer. And, I mean, it's good that I'm doing that, but at the same time, I'm not really seeking to develop my relationship with God. What I like to do a lot of the times, I'll get real quiet and I'll get alone and I'll get down on my knees and I'll just take a real deep breath and get real, real, real centered. And I'll incorporate the prayers out of this book, but I got to get honest with my God too. You know, it's like sometimes I just need to tell God that, you know, man, I'm not feeling real close to you today. And I love to talk to God like that. I don't try and, like, you know, King James it or blah, 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 and put a little spin on it, you know. I just like to talk to God and be real with God. If I'm not connected with God, I like to just, you know, God, I'm not connected with you, man. I don't like that. And I really need your guidance right now to show me how I can get back hooked up with you because I know that's what you want me to do, and I know that you want me to help your kids. And when I do that, I get the results, man. Simple as that. Sponsoring people, I got to get back to the book. I love this book. This book's so good. Jump in the pool after this. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. Those are two bold promises for me. There is nothing in this world that I've experienced that's more powerful than having somebody come up to you and asking you to work with them and for you to take them through the steps and to watch the light bulb go off in their head like it did Larry and me. To watch that happen is an experience you will not want to miss. The highlight of my day is speaking with sponsees. Sometimes I don't want to, man. Sometimes I just want to just, don't call me right now. I don't want to hear it. But that's being selfish, and I got to take their phone call, and I got to make myself a service to them because that's what I'm responsible for doing. You know, I've seen people all the time. They get sober, they go through the steps, they make their amends, and I'm one of them. I don't sponsor people, and what happens? I drink. I see it happen all the time, and it is vital for me to work with other people. It's so selfish for me to not offer this back to someone else. People in this program have done so much for me. It is unbelievable. And it's little things. It's like giving me, when I didn't have a car, it was giving me a ride to and from me, buying me a meal. Like, for me, like, what do you want from me? Why are you being nice to me? And it's my duty to give that back to people. It's the most amazing experience I've ever encountered in my entire life. I've got a couple of minutes, but I think I'm just going to end it there, so thanks.